Hi, welcome, folks. Jeff Sachs here from Mishkan Sipor, Masechet Kiddushin, Web Yeshiva. Hello to the folks online. Hello to the folks in the room, including some who are most welcome back. And we are glad to see you. Shalom is reporting that he was sadly in a betin connected to something with the Gittin, which is a skula for your own long happy marriage, Baruch Hashem. Yes, but you weren't an aide on the get or the masira or the ketiva. So Shalom says he asks the dayanim in the betin le'inyanei gerushin in Yerushalayim, who said nobody does a get mikushar today because it's not exactly clear how it's done. So I said there's also no real need for it. So Charlie says except for the kohen. So we saw last time that the Get Mikushar was instituted because it's very time-consuming and it's a whole pachki to make it done, and that would give Kohanim some time to change their mind because the consequences are for two reasons. One, because there's an idea that Kohanim are a little bit
it's a
little bit hot-blooded, a little bit quick to the trigger. No, Noach lichos v'noach l'ratzos. So if we give them a chance to calm down, maybe they'll decide that they don't really want to get divorced. But also there's a greater consequence for a Kohen to get divorced, because a Kohen can't marry a Grusha. And although there's the idea of Machzir Grusha, when you divorce a woman, you can't take her back. That's only if she's been married in between. But a Kohen, if he divorces a woman, she's a Grusha, and he can't take her back even that very same day. You wouldn't be surprised. This is the topic of an Agdon story called Rofei Ugrushato. In English, it's called the doctor's divorce. So since the consequences of a Kohen getting divorced are greater, so there's another reason. But in reality, you don't need to do this whole pachki with the Get Mikushar. I told you that the time that I went to be malave someone at a get, it's a whole long procedure. Now, if the Betin wants to schlep it out and set more time, it can just easily doing it by dragging its heels.
The sofer's sitting there
and he does it. And he does it at his own leisure. They said to us, like, after like all the procedural stuff was done, before the actual giving of the get had to first be written. And they said, look, it's gonna take some time. Let's just sit here. Which we did
before.
What?
Why aren't they allowed to write it before? In other words, you tell the sofer, write it, so when you come there, the get is already there.
Maybe you can.
In theory, you can, but that's not how it's done. In theory, that's how it's done. Maybe the reason it's not done is because of the same rationale of the get mikushar b'zeu.
But there are cases, by the way, where they try to remarry his own wife after the divorce. I heard of the case.
I mean, there are all types of cases of Kohanim doing things that
they can marry.
They should do.
Right? There are all types of Kohanim that discover that, once I want to marry a Grusha, not really a Kohen. That wasn't the case. Our much told story already, it was all sincere realignments of people's ichus. Nobody was.
Although I did find it interesting when comparing Ramosha Feinstein and Rav Soloveitchik in terms of how they dealt with this with his issues.
Of a Kohen discovering his Alevi,
a Kohen who, like a Baal Tshuva Kohen, who was married to someone he couldn't be married to.
Oh.
Whereas Ramosha was basically saying, oh, well, you know, we can, well, who just say you're really a Kohen, prove it, I can't prove it, you're probably not. And the Rav was like, well, nothing you can do, which he does show one as a posek and one as a philosopher.
As a lamdan, yeah. And the Rav, you know, certainly had strong opinions about what I see his article, Catharsis. Anyway, let's go back to the Gemara. We're on Daf Memtet Omud Aleph, 49a, towards the bottom, about nine lines up from the bottom or three fat lines from the top. The first one in the line is Hu im ita de polig natni, period, e boyis ema. This is where we kind of lost the thread last week as it was getting late and my eyes were getting dim.
Wait, how many lines from the...
In the wide lines, the third line, the middle of the third line.
Yeah.
Those of you online can...
Showing on the...
Yes, the folks online have the advantage that I highlight exactly where we are. the folks online have a disadvantage that they have to pour out their own whiskey. After 4 weeks of going dry, we all could use a stiff drink. So we raise a glass. L'chaim, Mishpailei, Tzavav, Haganal Yisrael, and everybody in harm's way should be home safe. That's what I said. The people in harm's way. Chatufim are in harm's way. Anyway, Eboyis Ema. So if you want, we can explain this whole thing the following way. What's this whole thing? The upgrades. We said if a person gives Hariat Mekudeshetli with this bara, with this coin of gold, and it turns out it's silver. Everyone agrees it doesn't work. Because that's a downgrade. You're cheating her. The value of silver is less than the value of gold. Hariat Mekudeshetli with this coin of silver, and it turns out to be gold, an upgrade. Tanakama says, B'chozok, it's no good. And Rabbi Shimon says, it is good. Of course it's good, right? In other words, it's more, it's better, it's an improvement. But that's not true about everything. Not everything is an upgrade. Rabbi Shimon says when it comes to an upgrade in Yichus, even Rabbi Shimon says, no. So if he says, Hariat Mekudeshetli, on the condition that I'm a Stami Yisrael, and it turns out he's a Kohen, if he says he's a Kohen, and it turns out he's a Yisrael, so Mestama, that's a downgrade, right?
Maybe.
So everybody agrees it's no good.
I'm going to say that.
But if he says I'm a... what?
Then we get to the point where maybe the woman decides whether she prefers that situation or not.
Yes, well, that's the sugya tonight, as you know from having learned ahead. So, but if he says I'm a Levi, and it turns out he's a Kohen, Mestama, it's an upgrade. And even there, Rabbi Shimon says, I agree with the Tanakama. Because as Eliot has now pointed out, giving spoiler alert, right? There are objective upgrades. $200 is more than $100. Can we all agree to that? Right? But not everything is objectively an upgrade. Even though on paper there's a hierarchy, Cohen, Levi, Yisrael, right? A distant third, right? Nevertheless, this is not exactly like the difference between $300, $200,
$100. There's another difference as well, which is related to that. In that something you mentioned last week, Tarusco, whatever, that it's someone, let's say you know, she really wanted the silver ring and you gave her gold. Mm-hmm. You can't have a gold ring, you get by silver.
Right.
But you can't switch you can't turn the guy into a coin back into a lady.
Right.
You're stuck. So it's also right. Fungible.
But she might not want a coin. That's she might not want a coin.
Again, this is what we're talking about tonight. So Eboy is saying, if you want to say this whole sugi is like this, Hachanami Shevach Yuchsin. When it comes to an improvement in a person's yichus, misavet. Who thinks my migudelet? You remember one of the cases was he says to her, Hariat Mikudeshidli, on the condition that I have an adult daughter or a shifcha, a servant. And that sounds like what?
Helper. Nice.
That sounds like a financial benefit.
Yeah.
Right? I'm going to marry you on condition we have live and help. But everybody agrees having a free servant or having to pay for a servant, which is better financially? A free servant. So what about this case? Shouldn't we think of this as financial improvement? In which case, Rabbi Shimon should agree that it's good, but he doesn't. So why? So the Gemara says, who says that this is a financial improvement? My migudelet, gadelet. Right? What does it mean? It means that she is, now this is a machloket. Right? Gadelet. So Rashi says, you see the Rashi at the bottom? Where's the Rashi?
Yeah.
Hashuva. Where's the Rashi?
On the first wide line of the Rashi at the end.
On the first line here, the first wide line of the Rashi, Migudelet Gdola Viruya Le Sham Sheni. That they're adults So I have a daughter. In other words, if you want to marry a woman, you say to her, oh, by the way, I've got a 6-month-old at home. So the woman might not think this is like such a great deal. It might be a minus. I mean, maybe she loves children and she loves orphans and whatever it is. But we all remember what it was like to have a 6-month-old at home. You know, they say that as the woman is still in the Sharon, feel free to chime in here and offer us a reality check. The only woman amongst us, the only mother amongst us. They say that while the woman is still in the delivery room, there are hormones that kick in. Here's a physician. You can confirm this. There are hormones that kick in that already start making her forget the severity of the pain. Because if she didn't, she'd never have another baby. Right? In other words, birth rate would be stuck at 1. Yeah. And 1 is not a... is not a is it, it's not for population
sustainable.
It's not sustainable. So women have that hormone. You know what men have? You know, we had 2 kids and then we had a big break, and then Baruch Hashem we had a 3rd child and then a 4th child. But in that long break between number 2 and number 3, so we bring the baby home from the hospital. I swear to you, he had completely forgotten about the whole mishigas with the diapers and changing diapers.
2 to 3.
Yeah, because we had a big break in between. But when our second one was born, our first one was still in diapers. But when our 3rd one was born, our older kids were already long toilet trained. And we came home from the hospital. I said, oh, yeah, diaper huggies. I completely forgot the
pack. Is that a hormonal?
And so it must have been the hormones. So my wife insists that with the younger children, I did a lot less diaper changing than with the older children. But there's certain things, you know, when you think back on those years of parenting small children, there are many wonderful memories. And there are other things that it's incredible how the memory can blot them out. And so I don't know, when you become a grandparent, well, you don't have to do any of that nasty stuff.
And I'm not even willing to.
Yeah. Pleasure to do it.
Okay. It's a pleasure to do it.
I'm a new grandfather. It's time to
enjoy it. My wife diapers more of the grandchildren than I do.
Yeah. So anyway, she says, I have an adult daughter. That's Rashi. So Rashi's saying, that she is an adult, that she's chashuva, that she's significant, right? That somehow it's you know, not so obvious that you want her around the house. Because
Lazar.
Right.
Lazar. She's in a position to help.
That's what Da'amara, he lo nichali gadil mamash. So my migudel. So don't think that it's gadil. Don't think that it means that she's there to help. Ella. Ella gadelet de amra he lo nichali ishakli mile mine va'ozla nedanya kame shavavute. No, I don't want I don't want a teenager in the house. Right? In other words, you're offering me, I'm going to have live and help with your daughter or with your maidservant. So it's not such a plus. I want a stepdaughter who's going to go and rat me out, who's going to tell Lashon Hara about me, who's going to gossip about me.
Cinderella.
Rabbeinu Hananel says, Mazem gadelet. Mi gadelet. Rabbeinu Hananel says, and the Rambam agrees with him. Here, look at pass this over. This is the Rambam, the corresponding Rambams. I'm sorry, I don't have it on the screen, but it's the Rambam in Hilchos Ishus, Perek Chet, Halacha Dalet and Hey.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I left one. I left the first level.
Oh, you've forgotten how popular the shiur has become.
No. I think I left off the relevant halacha, or one of the relevant halacha. The Rambam, that's fine. The Rambam agrees with Rabbi Yochanan. What's migadelet? A migadelet is, do you know?
Why? I looked ahead, so I can't pretend. I haven't looked ahead, so I can't pretend I didn't see.
It's a hairdresser, right? You know, like the beehive hairdo.
Yeah.
Right, which was popular in Talmudic times as well as in the 1950s.
Really?
Right?
A
migadelet is a migadelet se'ar, right? The hairdresser. Why that's the term, I assume it has something to do with that. David will look it up and let us know. So in other words, he says, Hariat Mikudeshet Li, because I have a daughter or a servant who'll be very useful to you because she'll be able to do your hair. She'll be able to do your hair. So, you know, even back in the times of the Talmud, the hairdresser was what? No. Was a gossip.
Right? The word saper. The word haircut is a talker, isn't it? I was telling.
Yeah, but I don't think that anything folk etymology. Sapar means to cut.
Yeah.
Right?
But it means it also
I think that's a folk etymology that the sapar, the haircutter, is the person who's misaper sipurim.
Yeah.
Why? But
It's a drush.
Nice drush.
It's a nice drush, and it reinforces the point, so we'll use it. But you know, like there's no end of movies and TV shows where you see this trope that the woman goes into the beauty salon, and that's where all the gossip is taking place, right? That's where all the gossip is taking place. And by the way, the men go into the barbershop, and it's a similar type thing. Like the old barbershop, you know, with the...
Or the mikvah.
What? Or the men's mikvah. So she says, having a servant who can do this, what's she going to do? She's going to go take what I say, and she's going to go to the next person, and... Right? And by the way, our mother-in-law, who I trust is not listening to the shir, so I can say this, had a housekeeper when she lived in New York. An Irish woman. And she did the rounds. She did all like the frum homes on the block. Sunday she was in this home, and Monday she was in that home, and Tuesday she was in that home. And my mother-in-law had like the lock that she came to her on Friday, because it's better to have the cleaning person come on Friday before Shabbat. So this lovely woman, she was with them for years and years and years. She would tell stories of what happens in the other home.
Sure.
And my mother-in-law said, but she doesn't, you know, She never says anything about what happens in our house. I'm like, why in the world would you think that? Why in the world would you? The only thing you know about this woman is that she's got loose lips. Right? But you think that about you, she doesn't say anything? Well, I'm blanking out her name. She had like flaming red hair.
Nice woman.
Phyllis.
Yes.
Right. You had Phyllis too?
Yes.
Must be the same Phyllis.
He told me all about you.
That's not me. It was my in-laws. De Omrahi lo nichali de shakla mili minai, that she should take my words, va'azla nadia kameshi v'votai, that she'll take my words and go and say them over by the neighbors. So having a servant, as we've now said a few times, is not objectively better. There are downsides to it, right? So even though there might be financial advantages to it, it's not exactly objective, right? It's not exactly objective.
Or desirable.
Right? It's not strictly speaking, shevach mamon. Right? It's a kind of, it's closer, it's more tantamount to shevach yichus. Right, to have improved, and if you have servants, that means you have a higher standing. But it's not necessarily objective financial gain, because even though you don't have to, you know, pay somebody that you trust on your own, it comes with drawbacks. But $200 doesn't come with drawbacks relative to $100.
The other one, you're actually spending money on.
Nachinami, you have to spend money on lots of things. If you,
me then, I was saying this woman is coming into the house.
It took your talk.
You know, not paying out money. There's no money.
Don't let it come back.
Right, but you can also
silver.
You don't like it. You find out that your hairdresser or that your maid is talking out of turn. What can you do? Yeah, you can't do that with your stepdaughter.
Even with money, it's not always strictly gain.
Why?
There's a difference between $9,000 and $10,000. $10,000 gets reported to the U.S. government, and you transfer.
That's a contemporary problem that the Chazal were unaware of, the different tax brackets. So here's a few other cases. Hariyat Mikudeshet Li, I'm sorry, Tanu Rabbanan. Now the Gemara introduces a brisa which offers a variety of... We'll come back to Rambam. Tanu Rabbanan, Almanat Sha'ani Karyana. You marry me on the condition that I am literate. Now, although, of course, literacy was very high amongst Jewish men in Talmudic times, it was not universal. Aaron Dembski, who lives in Rimon, Professor Aaron Dembski of Bar-Ilan University, who lives here in the Rimon, wrote a very interesting book about Jewish literacy, like rates of Jewish literacy and evidence of Jewish literacy in Chazal. To marry me on the condition that I am literate. So what's the mark of literate? In other words, all of these things. Marry me on the condition that I'm rich. How rich is rich? How much money do you have to be in order to be in the category of being called rich?
More than a
Kohen, on the condition that I'm a Kohen, that's objective. You either are or not a Kohen. Right? On the condition that I have a daughter, you either do or you don't. But that I'm literate. What's the mark of literacy? So all of these things have to be defined. What's the litmus test that tells you either are or aren't?
But the baseline for literacy should be Shtai Mikolachai Talmud.
Okay, why do you say that?
Because that's basic, you know, like if you're literate and you're learning or whatever, that's the basics of what you have to learn.
You're talking about knowledgeable. Literate means I am literate literally means I am able to read.
Okay, but the baseline for reading is like you have to read the parasha. You have to read the parasha twice a week.
As is often the case, Sal, you know a lot. And people don't appreciate how much you know or how much you remember from the previous time you saw this Gemara a few years ago. Right? Of course, you're onto something. If he's capable of reading three psukim, what does it mean to read three psukim in Beit Knesset? So we call it getting aliyah. Because in the days of Chazal, you got an aliyah, you laned the, right? Why three psukim? Because that's the minimum aliyah. So, what? We learned that together in Megillah, that's right. So if he's able to read three psukim, so literacy isn't you know like this literacy. You can read with nikud. Right? You remember when your kids are learning to read, right? It's not like they go from being not readers to readers in one fell swoop, right? There's a process and it improves, right? Because when your kids start learning to read, they wouldn't be able to read three psukim from a sefer Torah without nikud, without pisuk, without. And I'm not even talking here about tamei mikra. So there's reading is a spectrum. Literacy is a spectrum. So once you're able to get an aliyah and read the three psukim on your own, that means you're literate, and that would be the test of saying, yes, and if you can't do it, and he says, I'm literate, so they wouldn't be married.
But understanding.
That's how it says. Literacy is a function of being able to read the words.
The impression is also to understand.
From what are you under that impression?
Is a person illiterate if they don't really, they're just saying words?
That's not what the Gemara says, right? Literacy here seems to be a mark of the technique of translating these black on white symbols into speech, right? But what if he says, not that I'm literate. Harez, so Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ad shiyekra v'yitargim. So Rabbi Yehuda agrees with you. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, he has to be able to read it and targim. Targim to what? To?
Aramaic.
Mustama. But meaning, in order to translate it, he has to be able to understand what he said.
I'm curious about it. The word, you're translating Quran is to read, but I'm not sure that's necessary. I don't know if we have a precise word in English. It might be to recite, like likro the Torah is not actually. It's not like, I don't know if they did, just mm-hmm. reading into yourself. It is reading out loud. And to likro the Torah is actually to write the Torah. And that might be the difference here in just being able to read.
Well, I'm not sure. We'll see.
What are you saying, though?
I'm saying it's, I don't know how I would translate likro to read. I would maybe translate.
Well, there is no word likro here. The word here is karyen.
The Aramaic presumably is cognate with the Hebrew, but either one, even in Hebrew, likro didn't really mean it to read.
Right. Well, let's see. Hold on a second. So the Gemara says, wait a second. Rabbi Yehuda says he has to not only be able to mechanically read the words, he also has to be able to translate them, meaning indicate an understanding of the psukim. Yitargem mida'ate? What does that mean? Like a free translation, like off the top of his head, translating and explaining what the psukim mean? There's a separate problem with that. We're not allowed to translate psukim. Vahatanya, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, we also saw this in Megillah, Hametargem pasuk kitzurato, a person who translates a pasuk literally. Harei ze vadai. He is a falsifier. Because the psukim cannot be translated literally. Because the psukim come with a assumption of their part of an interpreted tradition of what the meaning of the psukim are, which always exceeds the literal translation. The hamosifalav, but if you add to the psukim, harezim charifu magadef, it's blasphemy. In other words, translation of biblical verses is a sticky wicket. Right? You can't do it literally, and you can't do it figuratively, which is why elamai tirgum didan. Right, our own tirgum, meaning the authorized tirgum, meaning unklus. That's what unklus is. Unklus is the.
How is he able to do it?
Because unklus had the Chazal thought unklus had certain whether it was Ruach HaKodesh or some lower level of inspiration, but it was somehow the authorized translator, as authorized by Chazal. Right, that, and even though we know that unklus doesn't always translate literally, and there's some very interesting cases of unklus kind of, it's a all translation is a form of
interpretation,
but unklus's translation is the translation of the Chumash, so it can't be. What's the problem? If we say that in order, what's the test for a guy's literacy in order to say he's married? If he says I'm literate, so Rabbi Yehuda says he has to read and translate. So what does it mean translate? He has to translate off the top of his head. Can't translate off the top of his head because otherwise he's either going to be a falsifier or a blasphemer if he doesn't walk the exact line. So it means he has to be able to read the psukim and also the unklus.
He has to remember the unklus. He has to be a scholar, not a guy who can read.
Can remember the unklus.
Vahani mili, all of this, de omer le karyana. That's if I say that I am literate. Aval, who has an English? Who has the English? What does the art scroll say?
He says, "We found that I am a reader of scripture."
A reader of scripture. Okay.
If you ask somebody, like, you know, can you lay? Doesn't mean that you know Hebrew. It means that you know how to read the Torah.
Aval amarla karaana. But if he says to her, "I am a reader," wait, that's the translation of karyana.
Oh, expert. The first one.
The first one is reader of scripture, and the other one is a scriptural expert. I'm a reader, meaning I have expertise in, right? Ad dekore oraita nevie uchtuve bidiuka. Right? If he says I'm a scriptural expert, so that means he's read all of Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, Ksuvim, bidiuka, with precision, meaning he really knows how to, what we would say, he knows how to read and learn and understand Tanakh.
That's interesting. Like in English universities, he reads history.
Yes. Yeah. Right. A reader of history in Oxford means that he is mastering that discipline. Al menat she'ani shone. What does that mean?
To learn.
That I learn, not on the condition that I'm different. Shone milashon vishinantam levanecha v'divartabam. That I'm a learner. What word do we know that derives from shone? Mishnah. So it's machlokas. Chizkiya amar halachot. Rabbi Yochanan amar Torah. What is halachot? You see Rashi on the bottom line. Halachot. Halacha la Moshe Misinai, says Rashi. I mean, this shone means that he knows like a certain scope of. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me turn this off. A certain scope of halacha. Halacha la Moshe Misinai. Halacha la Moshe Misinai might mean that he knows something about the halachic system, right? But Rabbi Yochanan says that he's learned Torah. Now, what's strange about that?
I would assume that halacha was Torah Shebal Peh and Torah was Torah Shebichtav.
That halacha is Torah Shebal Peh and Torah is Torah Shebichtav.
Never mind.
Okay. But if it's Torah Shebichtav, right? That's what Rashi says. Rashi says, Kasal Kadat Ka Torah Shebichtav. I would have said he means Torah Shebal. In a minute, we'll see. We have to reevaluate Rabbi Yochanan. But what's the problem with assigning Torah Shebichtav as the curriculum for what needs to be known in order to be able to say Al Menat Shani Shoneh?
It seems so.
Yeah. You know, there are different, in Hebrew, there are different terms. You know, like the Eskimos have 1,000 words for snow, which is not really true, but it's useful as a metaphor. That languages that either encounter something in greater frequency or value something with higher worth are going to create many more words to differentiate between nuances of
Wharfism.
Wharfism, yes, the wharf principle. The wharf, what's it called? The wharf something? For example, like we often do this. We often say, like, you know, how do you say this? There's a concept, like we Americans that come on Aliyah and our Hebrew is not yet fluent the minute we arrive. You have a year or two to perfect your Hebrew. You'll say, like, you know, how do you say that? You know, a distinctly American concept. How do you say that in Hebrew? And the joke will always be, there's no word for it in Hebrew because it doesn't exist. Right? Which is not true, of course, because all concepts have, you know, their
accountability is to say. That was one of the words.
Accountability.
Is that really a word in Hebrew?
No, apparently this week there's no word for taking responsibility because on Zehuze, they did a, you've been watching Zehuze, right? They've been doing this skit, you know, where like, you know, he. And you look at hot, and you look at right. Can't get it; gets caught in his throat. So you know, the old idea that Eskimos have 100 words for snow is not literally true, but it's metaphorically true in that regard. So in Hebrew, we have different words for different types of learning, right? If you don't learn Tanakh, you kore mikra, right? You read the scripture, right? Scripture means, right, that which is written in English, right? Script, but in Hebrew it's kra. The Tanakh is a written text is significant because it is recited, right? Even though we call it Torah Shebichtav, its significance to us is as a recited text, right? That we read it out loud, and our study of Tanakh is through the recitation of Tanakh. But Mishnah is shoneh, right? From like vishinantam levanecha. And you know the well known midrash that it's like from shen, right? Just like your teeth have to be sharp, your learning has to be sharp. You have to chew up the learning, right? You have to masticate it until you can then digest it. You know, very often, like now, this time of year, when Sof Zman Kriya Shema is very early. Sof Zman Kriya Shema this week is like at 8:35, 8:40. So if you come to the 8:30 minyan, you're going to miss it. So the Gaboyim announce you should say Kriya Shema before you come to shul. So they always make the same mistake. Say Chashuv lahagid Kriya Shema lifnei Shmona Arbaim. You don't magid Kriya Shema. You're kore Kriya Shema. You're kore Kriya Shema. In other words, there's a just like in Hebrew, you don't lovesh a kova. In English, you wear a hat, you wear gloves, you wear shoes, you wear a shirt. In Hebrew, you're hovesh kova, and you're lovesh chutzah, and you're noel sandal or noel na'alayim. There's a different verb for each different type of clothing. Why that is? Why did Hebrew develop that way?
They have a lot of things like that, don't they, Hebrew?
No, I mean, each language has its own quirks.
A lot of different things. They have different words. I forget where we learned it in the show. So.
Yeah, no, in other words... Yes. Right, you're right. In other words, there's katif and there's asif and there are different verbs for depending upon what you're harvesting. What in English you would say you're harvesting. You harvest wheat, you harvest grapes, you harvest olives.
That's what I wanted to say. For each one, they have a different.
In Hebrew, there's a different verb for each of those to distinguish between the different actions. And in English, I suppose we could find an example where it's the opposite, where one word does the job in Hebrew, but in English, there. Each language has its own.
We have like we'll say yad, in Hebrew and or regular with them neg. Whereas in Hebrew we have orif and lisa, which we don't really talk about neck. Well, the neck, we're basically saying neck for both.
Right. In English, neck is both here and here, and in Hebrew it's different. Generally speaking, Hebrew is a very
precise.
No. Hebrew is a very has a low number of words in its lexicon relative to English.
Yeah, sure.
Do you know what the numbers are? Hebrew is about a tenth the size of English. Now, there are a variety of reasons for this. Part of this is that Hebrew is a much purer language, and English is a kind of mongrel language that brought in words from all different types of other associations. And English had Hebrew, although a much more ancient language than English, was in the freezer for 2,000 years, and the language didn't develop at the same pace that it would have if it had continued to be a spoken everyday language throughout all of that period. But Hebrews, the arsenal of Hebrew words in the otsar milim, the vocabulary is much smaller. So it's not surprising that in English you would have a variety of that. In Hebrew, one word would cover lots of different things. And in English, for example, by the way, in writing, this is a tangent, but I discover this all the time in my editing work. Particularly when you're working with native Hebrew speakers that are writing in English, they all think they can write English very goodly.
It's very Welsh.
But what happens is that they'll use, what's a writerly tick that's generally considered poor writing in English, to use the same word over and over again.
That's true.
Right? Now, part of that is writing in English, a native Hebrew speaker just doesn't have access to the same vocabulary that a native English speaker has. But part of it is that in Hebrew, that works. In Hebrew,
choose a different word, has a different meaning.
No, but in Hebrew, because Hebrew tolerates repetitive use of the same word, because it had, no, listen, Hebrew tolerates repetitive use of the same word in writing, because you're starting off with a much smaller set of synonyms. So you can't be expected to vary it the same way that you do in English. And what's considered a flaw in English writing is not a flaw in Hebrew writing, because Hebrew just simply can't accommodate the need to use four different synonyms. And therefore, it's much more acceptable to use the same word again and again. If I had prepared something, I could have shown you examples of how this works.
I recommend, if you're interested about this kind of thing, the book by the linguist, the original Israeli, Guy
Deutscher.
Unfolding of language.
Yeah, I have it at home if anybody wants to borrow it.
And it really just talks about how languages, expand the vocabularies, contract the vocabularies, it's just the way they can go. It's really a beautiful book.
Yeah, I have that book at home if anybody wants to borrow it. Guy Deutscher.
Inuit Indians have 53 words for snow.
Mm-hmm.
The Yupik Indians from Siberia have 40.
Okay, that's still a lot of words. What do we have? We have snow and slush.
Sleet.
Sleet.
He fails. Who's that?
Powder.
Aval amalo. So shone. So if he's so Chizkiah says, if he says that he's a shani shone, that I'm a learner, Chizkiah says yes to know halachot, which Rashi says means halacha le Moshe misinai. But what others, including the Rambam and Rabbeinu Hananel and the Meiri, say means, what would be the alternative to saying halachot?
Mishnah.
Obviously, shoneh means that you know the Mishnah, right? Which makes sense to have in a text that comes from a Braisa. It can't be the Gemara. It predates the Gemara. But Rabbi Yochanan says it means Torah. So how can it mean Torah? Shoneh Torah? You don't say shoneh Torah. So metfei, there's an attack on this from another Braisa. Ezehi Mishnah, what is the Mishnah? We know what the Mishnah is. It's those books over there. But in the times of the Tanoim, when the Tanoim talked about Mishnah, the word Mishnah predates the code prepared by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Shisha Sidre Mishnah. What did they mean when they said Mishnah? Before it becomes the proper name of this codified work of Tanaitic literature.
It's passed down orally.
So Rabbi Meir Omer Halachot, Rabbi Yehuda Omer Midrash. Right?
Both true.
Well, in other words, is it the halachic material or is it the Midrash?
They're both.
Well, there's a, when he says, Almanat Shani Shoneh, that you're married to me on the condition that I am X, what is X? Does it mean that he has some kind of knowledge of the halachic code of the Torah Shebaal Peh? Or is it the Midrash? Now, by the Midrash, what does it mean, the Midrash? Does it mean the Agadot? No, it probably means the Midrash Halacha.
You could say Mishnah is Torah from a Pasuk, Mishinam from the Vanecha.
Yeah.
It's the same root for in the Torah.
Okay, but by the time Chazal start to use it, it takes on a very different meaning. It's also not clear that when the Torah says Vishinantam Levanecha Vidibarta Bam, right? What's Bam? It's not just the Mikra. It's even the Torah may have been aware that the Torah itself is insufficient, meaning the Torah is always part of an interpreted tradition, because Torah Shebichtav alone can't do the job. What would it mean to teach your child Totefot Beinecha? That's the Mikra, that's the Pasuk. But in and of itself, as Ramban famously points out, is meaningless, because we don't even know what the word Totefot might as well be.
Whiskey.
What?
Whiskey.
Could be, well, wouldn't it be great if it was whiskey? Every morning you come to shul. Oh, maybe that's what those old guys in shul used to do. No, the word Totefot might as well be in hieroglyphics. Right? You know, like sometimes you're reading, it depends on what you read, I suppose. But some things that I read, every now and then there'll be a word that'll appear in Greek.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like in a journal article. In a journal article. Right? There'll be a word in Greek or in Latin. My Latin is passable. I studied Latin 2 years in high school and 1 year at YU. My Latin is passable. But my Greek is, I can read, but I can't understand. Meaning I can decipher the letters. But imagine it's like hieroglyphics, right? Meaning like when you're reading, you get to the hieroglyphic, you just skip over it, right? So the word Totefot is like that. It has no meaning to us, right? So it only works if you know that there's a Torah Shebaal Peh that goes along with it. The Totefot are these boxes and they're black and they have these parashiyot written in them.
That's the whole description of it. But I mean, there is translation. They're both frontlets.
In other words, you're translating a word I don't understand with a word I don't understand. Phylactery.
Another Greek word.
The word phylactery, I learned this from my friend Shai Charka, the cartoonist. In French, in an old, not old French like Rashi, but in an older French than it's used today. No contemporary French speaker. I once asked Emmanuel Navon this. He didn't know. No contemporary Frenchman would get this. But the word phylactery in French was used, Charka is a cartoonist, you know, he does the political cartoons in Makori Shon. In comics, you know, the thought bubble, right? At a certain point in French, it was called flacteré. Because what is it? It's a box that contains text.
Really?
So, so that's the word phylacteries, right? So you take a word you don't understand, you have to, but totafot only makes sense it with an interpretive tradition. Besukot teshu shivat yamim. What's Sukkot? Right? Sukkot, but even if it's Sukkot mamash, I need to know what Sukkot is. Right? And that's the Torah Shel Peh. That's the halacha of Moshe Mitzrayim. I mean, presumably Moshe is on Sinai taking dictation. And Hashem says, Besukot teshu shivat yamim. So Moshe is jotting it down. He says, hey, what's Sukkot? So the Bible says it's four walls with three walls or two and a half walls, and a wall is this high. And what?
Yeah.
Chamtza meruba metzilta, right? Tzilta meruba chamtza.
Yeah.
I'm muted, you all. So that's the interpretive. That's probably what's meant by midrash. Midrash probably doesn't mean what we call midrash agadah. The sun and the moon were having an argument about who would be in charge. That's also midrash, but there's midrash halacha and there's midrash agadah. So my Torah. So what could it mean when Rabbi Yochanan says he has to know Torah? It must mean that he means midrash Torah. What we call Torah Shebaal Peh, right? So either you need to know the halachot, or you need to know Torah Shebaal Peh, which seem to be overlapped. Maybe it's two different ways of saying the same thing, right? They're certainly overlapping realms. Halachot and Torah. Maybe halacha means halacha psuka, and Torah Shebaal Peh is Torah Shebaal Peh. V'hani mili de Omar la tanina, aval Omar la tana. If he says tanina, I have studied the Tanaitic works. What? In other words, the Tanaim.
Such the Aramaic version of Shane.
The Tana is just in Aramaic. The Shin in Hebrew becomes a Tuf in Aramaic. So Shin Nun He in Hebrew becomes Tuf Nun Aleph in Aramaic. So the Tanaim are the authors of the Mishnah. If I had a blackboard, it'd be easy to demonstrate this, right? Because what is Tanaim in Hebrew? Shonim, right? The teachers of the Mishnah, right? Or the rabbis of that period of the, right? So the Tanaitic literature, the rabbinic literature that comes out from this period, which ends at around the year 200 after zero, 200 CE, with the codification of the Mishnah. And then you go over to the period of the Amoraim. Why are they called Amoraim?
Disgusting.
Because they talked all the time. Yep. All they did was talk. They were so in love with the Torah, they couldn't stop talking about it. Right? The yappers, we might call them. All they did was discuss and debate. Right? You've learned Gemara. You know what it's like. Right? But the Tanaim were the ones that were interested in the Shinun. Right, in the getting it right, chewing through all of the halachot to get to this code, which Rabbi Yehuda Nasi puts together. So if he says, Tanina, I have studied the Tanaitic literature, aval amar la tana'ana, I'm one of the Tanaim. I am like a Tana. So what would that mean? If somebody says, Hariat Mekudeshli, on the condition I'm a rabbi, so what does that mean? It doesn't mean much.
Right? It means a lot of things to different people.
But the point is that, you know, like, I'll put my hands on you, we'll say you're a rabbi, right? You'll say, I'm Rabbi Charlie, right? And so you could say, I'm Rabbi Charlie. There aren't really any, I mean, like, any given yeshiva might have, like, standards, right? But really, anybody can be a rabbi. But he can't say, but on the condition that I am a Tana. So that's already something different, right? Anna Tana Anna Ad the Tane Hilchata Safra Sifre Vitosefta. You have to know the halakha that we discussed, the Sifra, which is the Midrash Halakha on Vayikra, we call Torat Kohanim, the Sifrei, which is the Midrash Halakha on Bamidbar and Dvarim, and the Tosefta. What's the Tosefta? The Tosefta is the appendix to the Mishnah. Right? So here you see, obviously, Hilchata means what? Hilchata here must mean Mishnah, which is why it makes sense to say that when Chizkiah says you have to know the halachot, it means you have to know the Mishnah. Halachot is a code word for knowing the Mishnah, right? Because here, how could it not be? How could it be anything else? If he says I'm a Tana, or I'm on the level of the Tanaim, so what's the one thing you need to absolutely know in order to be a Tana? The Mishnah, right? We also want you to know the Tosefta. What's the Tosefta? The Tosefta is all the other stuff that didn't get included in the Mishnah, but is like an appendix to the Mishnah. And you also, well, in other words, they're all the things that the Tanaim said. It was oral. Not everything could be codified in the Mishnah, right? Anything that was left out of the Mishnah is technically a brisa. The word brisa, you've corrected me in the past on this, or you wrote an article, brisa technically means bachutz, meaning anything that was not included outside of the Mishnah. But the brisa itself, some of that was collected into an anthology which looks and smells a lot like the Mishnah, but is of secondary authority to the Mishnah. And that's Tosefta. By the way, where do you find the Tosefta? Usually it's printed in the back of the Gemara, not in the art scroll necessarily, but in the back of the Gemara, Steinsaltz has. In the back of the Gemara is the Tosefta. But of course, there are scholarly editions of the Tosefta, most famously by Shaul Lieberman. There's scholarly editions of the Tosefta, academic editions of the, you know, or separate printings of the Tosefta. But if you read a Tosefta, it looks and smells a lot like a Mishnah, right? Sometimes the Toseftas are very parallel to the Mishnah with only minor differences. So what about the material, the statements that the Amoraim said that weren't codified in the Mishnah, weren't codified in the Tosefta? Those are just regular Braitiot. It's a little confusing because technically Tosefta is also Braita. But when we colloquially, when we say a Braita, we mean something that was neither codified in the Mishnah nor in the Tosefta. So how do we know them? Because the Amoraim still preserve them orally and are quoting them all the time. As a matter of fact, we are in the middle of studying one right now. Anything that begins Tanu Rabbanan means a Braita.
B'shei Halacha are considered Braita?
What?
B'shei Halacha are considered Braita?
I don't think so. I don't know. I think it's a different category, a different genre.
Also, what? Tanya, no?
That's a great title.
Tanya is a bright. No doubt there were statements made by the Tanoim that weren't codified in the Mishnah or the Tosefta or quoted by the Amoraim and preserved in the Gemara that were lost to us. Right? That's the way it is. I mean, there were probably all types. Not every
Rabbi Yehuda intended.
Right. Well, I guess. Yeah.
A new edition of the Mishnah that we had in English.
Yes, this is new from Oxford. It was a team of people did it. I think he was the editor. Yeah.
He was interviewed with him on a podcast about the Mishnah. Fascinating, really interesting discussion. Something like that.
Almenat Sha'ani Talmid, but if he says on the condition that I'm a Talmid, what's a Talmid? Right? Well, I mean, every kid that goes to first grade is a Talmid. Right? So it must mean something else. Ein Omrim Keshimon Ben Azai U Keshimon Ben Zoma. Right? You don't need to be one of the holy rollers. Right? You don't need to be the Vilna Gaon. Right? Ela Kol Shesholin Oto Kol Shesholin Oto be Mazi? Bechol Makom Davar Echad Belimudo Veomro somebody who's a learner. And you say, like, what are you learning? And he seems to know what he's talking about. Like a yeshiva guy. You know what a yeshiva guy is like? Yeshiva guy is like he's in it. Right? And you say to him, like, you know, what about the Gemara in Eruvin? He doesn't say, never heard of it. Right? He seems to know what's going on. He's like immersed in the world of learning. I've told this story a number of times that when I was in yeshiva, we were learning a borer, Hilchot Borer. Borer is a simple concept that we made a hash of. Right? Borer on Shabbat, you know, there's two things, the things you want and the things you don't want, and they're all mixed together. Right? The things you want are called ochel, and the things you don't want are called psolet. It doesn't have to be edible either. It could be silverware all in a jumble. It could be who knows what. So we're in yeshiva and we're learning borer. And, you know, in yeshiva, they serve those carrots and peas. The carrots are chopped up in little squares and peas. No, so there's somebody sitting there. He doesn't like the peas, so he's picking out the peas. The guy across from him says, that's bull rare! And the first guy says, today's Wednesday! But when you're learning, it's like, when you're learning Hilchos Shabbos, it's always Shabbos. Right? So that's he says, I'm a Talmud. So it means you ask him about learning, he knows what he's talking about. As we say in Yiddish translated English, he's holding and learning. And even in Mesechet Kala. What's Mesechet Kala? There's something called the Masechtot HaKetanot. In English, they're called the minor tractates. They're generally collections of brightiot. What?
Sounds like a different interpretation.
I know. There are different interpretations to this. So Masechet Kala is one of the minor tractates. Now, so either it means he knows something a little obscure, or it means he knows something that's rather light. The Masechtot Ketanot are not heavy. What?
They have no Gemaras.
They're not even Mishnah. It's really, they're not technically Masechtot like Masechet Shabbat. Yeah, sometimes they're printed in the back, but they're a collection of brightiot on different themes. So Masechet Kala is about things related to marital relations. But it's fairly easygoing. It's not deep, complicated learning. But it's a bit obscure. It's not usually on the regular curriculum.
So this discussion is actually having you saying that he's buffing in these certain Masechet Kalot before the Talmud is even written.
I don't know.
Well, Talmud doesn't start the writing with the Talmud.
So either it means Masechet Kala means he knows even these light things, or it means these obscure things, or it doesn't mean Masechet Kala at all. Right? Masechet Kala might mean what was learned at the Yarche Kala.
Okay.
The Yarche Kala were these twice a year learning festivals where people would gather to learn, and even people that weren't learning all year. Even the farmers and the agricultural workers and the people that weren't into learning would come and would be like one of these learn fests. And things that were learned at the Yarche Kala may have been things that were much more widespread. There were things that were much more well known. You know, it's like this. There's certain Vortlach that everybody knows, right? There's certain, I don't know, like if I say to you, Ilu kervanu lifnei har Sinai velo natan lanu et haTorah dayenu. So what's the next vort?
What would be
the value of bringing us to Sinai and not giving us the Torah? It's like the most worn out Leila Seder drusha that every first grader knows, right? So maybe that's what it means, that he knows. How much do you need to know? You need to know like these well known. Like to say that you're a Talmud, if you don't know that little vertel that everybody knows, so you can't say you're a Talmud. Okay, we'll have to stop there, but we're in the middle of this brisa. We'll continue from there.
What?
Oh, I guess, yeah. Somebody have a pen? Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
Oh, that's all gone. Oh, okay.